This week on Rabble Radio, we're sharing a clip from our June Off the Hill political panel. In this panel, our distinguished guests, Ariel Deranger, Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action, Clayton Thomas Mueller, author and activist, Sabrina Grover, political strategist and communications expert, former NDP MPP Joel Hardin, and Rabble's own parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg explore the implications of Prime Minister Mark Carney's commitment to making Canada an energy superpower. The discussion delves into how this vision intersects with Indigenous sovereignty, pipeline development, and Canada's climate commitments. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
But we're going to begin actually with Joel. And while, as you heard, our panel today is mostly focused on pipelines and land back, I think it's helpful to begin with the context of Mark Carney's government, his first 60 days as Prime Minister, especially as we've just had the G7. So to you, Joel, what are the main takeaways from Parliament's first few weeks?
Well, thanks, Libby, and thanks, everybody, for the opportunity to be here. I would say there are two large narratives that are swirling around in our city, and Sabrina and Robin can think differently than me, perhaps. We all are in the same city here. One narrative is big disappointment in the notion that the full court press that the fossil fuel industry put on towards the end of the election, 38 executives writing an open letter to Carney calling for speeding up pipeline approvals, infrastructure approvals, the end to the industrial carbon tax, the end to the emissions cap in oil and gas. It would seem that Carney is responding directly to that. That's the critical take. The charitable take is to say, oh, he's playing 3D chess. You know, he's saying yes to pipelines, but he knows that these pipeline projects aren't going to be funded. And therefore, he's going to focus more on unifying electrical systems. You know, I hear that as well from neighbors. What matters to me the most is that our country is not divided by the fossil fuel industry. And that's what I see going on here. I see their full court press to do whatever they can to extract every single cent from our shared earth towards their very short-term minded goals. And what I want to see is a prime minister that's going to stand up very clearly with the science and with the evidence and with our constitutional obligations and say emphatically, no, let's follow the lead of the green energy revolution that's happening around the world.
And just a quick follow-up, Joel, how is that playing out in Parliament itself? It's a minority Parliament. Is he getting pushback?
Well, the Conservatives, the official opposition, have said they're going to vote in favor of Bill C-5. That's very clear. I've seen organized labor offer some critical support for Bill C-5. So we've got, you know, some major institutional players in the country that seem to be persuaded of the merits of this bill. But again, what I'm hearing from neighbors here is we have to deal with the world that actually exists and not play this 3D chess game of let's pacify the fossil fuel industry and actually do stuff on the other hand. I come from the school of thought, Libby, and I know you do too, that it's best to be straight with voters. It's best to be direct. Mm-hmm. And I don't think energy workers in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Newfoundland, Labrador, BC, or anywhere else are helped by inflating expectations of massive 12, 15-year infrastructure projects that'll be stranded assets at the end. I want to see those energy workers put to work in building the next energy economy. And many of them are already doing it. They're already doing it right now. And I want to see our federal government get behind them with subsidies and not the fossil fuel industry.
Right. Thank you for that. Ariel, let's go to you. On June the 5th, your organization, Indigenous Climate Action, released its Phase 2 report on decolonizing climate policy. The Phase 2 report is a follow-up to the Phase 1 report that Indigenous Climate Action released in December 2023. So can you first start by just explaining what it means to decolonize climate policy, and then we'll get into the report?
Just in a short little summary, I think that the reality is this new or this latest version that we've released, Phase 2 of Part 2 of our decolonizing climate policy work, is titled Land Back is Climate Policy. And so when we talk about decolonizing climate policy, it's about recentering the values that drive policies that govern the land, the people, and our systems that we use to survive and thrive. And for us, this is rooted in an ideology of land back, but really what that means is interconnections with the land. We cannot be developing and continuing to develop and be guided by colonial policy that is disconnected from the lands and from the peoples that have existed in these lands and territories since time immemorial. So this report and the series of reports that we've done on decolonizing climate policy are really calls to action about how we can recenter and imagine policies that are away from colonial systems and structures that aim to control and work against the well-being of people and the planet. And so we're reimagining what climate policy could and should be rooted in, the understanding that Indigenous approaches to policy are grounded in self-determination and sovereignty of each individual Indigenous nation. And the conversations that we've had over the last few years, really starting in 2020, really 2019, really looks at like what it means for us to look at Indigenous policy. Rather, excuse me, I have a bit of a cold. So we're not trying to create a homogenous like pan-Indigeneity, but we think that policies should be respective to each diverse nation. And there's no one silver bullet or way to move forward with climate policies, but they need to be grounded in the community's natural laws and ways of being, rather than being imposed on communities from a top-down approach. We think that Indigenous-led solutions need to be rooted in traditional knowledges, and that these are not some sort of antiquated going back to, but rather they're innovative. They're creative solutions that tackle modern problems and the current crises we're in. And so this isn't about just looking at the standard sort of off-the-shelf approaches we think about when we think of climate policy. You know, we often think of just transition and energy transformation, which we need, but we also need to have a shift in our value systems that drive policies. And so many of the calls to action in this are talking about what are those alternatives? What are the alternatives to the standard approaches that we look at? This is relocalizing governance and economies, reconnection to land, culture, and language. This is revitalization and the resurgence of Indigenous food sovereignty, energy sovereignty, including taking care of the lands and waters, taking care of the forests, taking care of our animal relatives and their habitats, taking care of our cities, taking care of our waste, transforming legal systems to protect what we value and require. And when you start to really reimagine decolonial climate policy, it is about shifting away from these ideologies of colonial capitalism that has put us in the crisis that we're in. So we need to look at ways to recenter Indigenous ways of knowing and being, and decentering settler ways. We need to respect the assertion and the defense and the of land defenders, respecting Indigenous self-determination and sovereignty and consent. I don't want to hear any more about consultation, which is really worrisome what we're hearing with Carney. When we're watering down and speeding up the processes for approvals, we're further degrading the free, prior, and informed consent that is upheld in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And we're watering it down to a further degradation of consultation when, in fact, we have legally affirmed rights for consent. We need to be able to say yes or no to projects. And we need to be talking about the redistribution of power, wealth, and land, i.e. land back. And of course, we need to decentralize climate governance and building community power. So we need to be talking about how we can have community power rather than top-down approaches, and building intersectional, powerful international movements that ensure accountability across the board for all of our communities and move towards reparation. Because the current path we're on is just about continuing to build, amass political and economic power at all costs and any cost. And that tends to be people and the planet, that tends to be Indigenous communities and those that are most marginalized. And we desperately need a movement towards decolonial climate policy and a movement towards Indigenous land back.
Thank you, Libby.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, over to Sabrina now. Let's bring you in. We mentioned in the introduction Bill C-5, the Building Canada Act. I think it was the second bill that the Prime Minister introduced. But it's certainly a core economic and political foundation, Sabrina. And we're very interested to get your perspective on that in terms of Carney's agenda and how you see that. And is he going to run into trouble in meeting climate commitments and Canada's constitutional obligations to Indigenous peoples. I mean, we've heard some of that from Ariel, but just to get your take on that from maybe from Carney's perspective, how you see him thinking that through.
Yeah, thanks so much, Libby. And I really do appreciate Ariel's perspective and also the work that that organization has done in this field. I think, let me start with a bit of a high level kind of look, I think, in response to what Joel had to say in terms of how Mark Carney is being received. So some of the recent polling on both this issue and on Mark Carney's government or mandate so far is looking positive, right? So right now we have about 67% of total approval for Carney across the country. When you get down to issues of whether it's, you know, building this one economy, or we even talk about, you know, the speed of projects, you have all, over 70% approval rates on the performance of the government, either as good or acceptable in the speed of major projects and building infrastructure. And that includes, of course, this idea of pipelines. And, you know, we've got over 70% of support in building the Canadian economy in accordance with Bill C-5, kind of removing those trade barriers to interprovincial trade and identifying and expediting nation-building projects. So there is a lot of support, and that support is consistent across the country, which is unique for the first time, I think, including in Mark Carney's performance, that including in Alberta, which is actually where I am, Joel, not in Ottawa, including in Alberta, there is a lot of support for the work that he's doing. And I think a lot of it is because of the external threats that people are facing or are perceived to be facing from the United States, right? The United States is a really unpredictable partner, and we've seen that even in the last, you know, 4 days. So I think just kind of using that as stage setting is, while I do think that they are going to run into many issues in how they have so far engaged with First Nations and Indigenous communities, there is still support broadly for getting projects built and making sure that Canada can be an energy superpower. And an energy superpower doesn't mean just conventional oil and gas. And you've heard Tim Hodgson and Mark Carney, and including actually Premier Smith, surprisingly, talk about some of these clean energy projects. I think Premier Smith remains to be seen whether or not she actually thinks that that's important or falls back onto, you know, this idea of conventional oil and gas only. I think the number one thing, in addition to this free prior and informed consent that needs to be obtained, is what is the economic partnership between Canada and First Nations, and what is the economic partnership that ensures that there is an economic side to reconciliation in building these projects, that it isn't at the expense of any group, and that it isn't at the pain of any one group, but that it does become an economic partnership and true partnership in terms of that reconciliation path forward. And I think that that hasn't been identified yet. So it's not to say that perhaps it won't come, but I will say that it is going to cause some problems for the Carney government in getting projects done if they don't identify that. And if they don't identify a path forward for a good working relationship right from the beginning, and they have lacked on that development of a good working relationship, or they haven't been able to identify it for us yet. What I'd like to see, I think, is a greater presence of not just Tim Hodgson in these conversations, but additionally the presence of the people who are the ministers who are negotiating or charged with negotiating with First Nations. And we haven't seen that at all. And there was a lot of work done that was moving in the positive direction under Justin Trudeau. And it seems to have either stalled or we don't actually know where it's going. And I think, again, that needs to become more relevant and more front of mind for the Carney government. I think that there's an opportunity on that side to move forward. But so far, I don't think we have the path forward on that.
All right. Thank you for that, Sabrina. All right. Clayton, let's bring you in. You are a consistent advocate for land back and Indigenous rights. The government's new mega bill we've been talking about, Bill C-5, the Bill in Canada Act, allows the government to bypass key provisions that guarantee consultation with Indigenous communities and environmental stuff. What impact will this have?
Well, first and foremost, hello to all the listeners that are checking in from across these lands they call Canada. I wanted to just first and foremost recognize the 31,000 plus climate refugees that have been evacuated from over 35 First Nations, in fire zones across the north. Climate change continues to be a very disruptive and very violent and unpredictable thing, especially for frontline communities that are impacted not just by climate change, but also by the extractive industries here in Canada that are driving climate change in terms of disruption of water security and food security and the violation of treaty and inherent rights. Now, right now, I'm just having all kinds of traumatic flashbacks of the omnibus bill under Prime Minister Harper way back in the day when the great First Nations women of these lands stood up under the guise of Idle No More and, put a big challenge out. And of course, that was the beginning of the demise of the Harper regime and the lead to this now current Liberal system. I agree with a lot of commentary that, Carney is presenting just as bad as the Conservatives. You know, it's no wonder they're voting for the omnibus bill C-5. It's really important to understand that, we're deep right now in the battle of the story. You know, the government, will put out their assumptions or their understanding of the current political and geopolitical or whatever landscape, and especially their interpretation of their relationship with Indigenous peoples. They'll put that shit out there in the media, right? And Indigenous peoples, we'll put our stuff out there as well. And at the end of the day, this stuff is fought out in a couple different places. And I think most notably on the colonial side of things in the Supreme Court of Canada. And so as our national chief, Cindy Woodhouse, said today in the media, we're in court right now. We'll continue to be in court. And, in response to Bill C-5, this will probably end up in the court. And the government is selling this as a pathway for meaningful engagement, cultural and environmental stewardship. But this couldn't be more disingenuous. The act's purpose includes respect for Indigenous rights. But to that end, the Act mentions six situations for Crown First Nations consultation concerning large construction projects to extract and transport natural resources on treaty lands. I'm not going to list those out, but the provisions of Bill C-5 are really about Canada, Carney trying to put it out there that he pledges to consult with First Nations about the possible infringement of Aboriginal and treaty rights. That vow to consult, however, has nothing to do with Bill C-5's passage into legislation. Canada must already consult. It's a permanent feature of settled constitutional law, not a potential consequence of Bill C-5. So Bill C-5 also speaks about the establishment of a federal major projects office. Now, it's not obvious to me how this new office may differ from the major projects management office established in 2007. Maybe a difference is the appointment of an Indigenous advisory council or advisory bodies. But, historically, advisory bodies and federal things like this have not been known to produce meaningful results for First Nations. And, I think another really important thing is around FPIC. There's a preambular reference in Bill C-5 to free, prior, and informed consent. And I know from, previous litigations against Canada's Justice Department that Canada sees the duty to consult and FPIC as the same thing. Again, interpretations. And it is therefore doubtful that Bill C-5's implicit reference to FPIC will improve in any way Canada's approach to consulting with First Nations. And we've seen, Canada's devastating record under all political platforms in that note. Bill C-5, you know, I think the reality of it is that little, absolutely little is gained by First Nations. First Nations are about to face a massive and very rapid, accelerated period of rights-threatening resource extraction. And while Bill C-5 might boost investor confidence, you know, foreign direct investment in the Canadian economy, for First Nations rights holders, the status quo or business as usual is very much represented by this. And again, this is just the usual dupe and delay tactics of proponents of the fossil fuel sector, of proponents of the critical minerals sector. And it's very troubling. You know, I'm interested to hear what the other regions are dealing with. But here in Manitoba, you know, Carney has prioritized the newly ice-free shipping lanes for, you know, the establishment of new trading routes to free us up from, you know, the dilemma we face with our biggest trading partner, the United States of America. You know, Carney is the darling child of the monarchy of Europe, of the European Union. You know, this guy is really their quarterback that they've pulled out during this time. And so Indigenous peoples, you know, I call out to all of you that this is a time where we have to be coming together, to be having meetings in our community, you know, around the dinner table, at the workplace, in our place of prayer, to, you know, make sure that we're keeping tabs on what's going on with this conversation. Because I really feel with this accelerated, you know, resource development timeframe that we're facing and this fast tracking of fiduciary and legal obligation, particularly around consultation and project finance and project ownership, these are very scary times because there's a lot of our Native people, just like any other demographic in Canada, that are, you know, hardcore capitalists. They don't care about the environment. They don't believe in climate science. Well, there's a lot of us Indigenous peoples that do, and we need to be hitting the streets right now and letting our voices heard all across these lands that they call Canada, that we're not going to stand idly by when these folks are coming to try and build pipelines over our salmon-producing rivers or to dredge the beluga sanctuary in the Hudson Bay so LNG super tankers and coal export barges and, you know, oil tankers can come into to the Hudson Bay, threatening the food security of Indigenous peoples and northern communities there. You know, we need development in the north. We need highways to be built. We need, you know, infrastructure like the purchasing of water.
That was a small clip from our most recent Off the Hill panel on climate policy, pipelines, and land back. To watch the full panel, please visit rabble.ca/rabbletv or visit Rabble's YouTube channel. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Let's dive right in. Starting in labor news, personal care workers at the Villa Colombo Assisted Living Facility in Toronto have been on strike for a month now. Represented by QP Local 5525, these workers are fighting to reach their first collective agreement with their employer. They say that their employer has threatened to claw back existing benefits that they receive, as well as have full-time employees work weekends in addition to their Monday to Friday shifts. The employees, who already work for less than minimum wage, say that these demands would put unreasonable strain on their lives. Stephanie Heroder, who has worked at Villa Colombo for 4 years, explained the stress that she is under, saying, quote, "I have 4 kids and I have both of my parents who are seniors who I take care of. I have 2 part-time jobs and I have this one because it is not enough. It is not fair," end quote. Also in labor news, Canada Post workers represented by the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, or CUPW, have been ordered to vote on the latest offer from their employer by the federal government. CUPW has been negotiating with Canada Post for 18 months, and this period even saw a brief strike in November of last year. The union is defending rural mail routes as well as retaining manageable work hours as Canada Post seeks to impose more flex shifts on part-time workers. CUPW has instructed their members to vote no on the offer from Canada Post and have condemned the federal government for intervening and their right to negotiate with their employer, saying in a statement, quote, We will not stand by as the government and Canada Post work together to try to undermine our hard-fought rights, gut our collective agreements, and rewrite them on their own terms. Postal workers know how to fight back. We've done it before, and we're ready to do it again. End quote. At the time of this recording, no date has been set yet for these votes to take place. In provincial news, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith is being criticized for charging residents in her province to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. The COVID-19 virus is still with us and returns seasonally in waves like the flu. Also like the flu, the virus mutates from year to year, increasing the need for a new vaccine shot each season. Seniors, the very young, and those with compromised immune systems remain vulnerable to serious complications or even death from COVID-19. As well, there are those who suffer from long COVID after contracting the disease, with symptoms lasting for years. Danielle Smith, a longtime promoter of vaccine conspiracy theories, says that most people in her province don't want to receive the vaccine at all, and that it wasn't fair for the public to bear the cost of the vaccine when it is allegedly used by so few people. As of June last year, more than 16% of Albertans had received at least one dose of the vaccine, according to the most recent data available from the federal government. Last November, the Alberta government announced that the vaccine would no longer be available at all at provincially run community medical clinics. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki is calling out the disturbing trend of government leaders disregarding the preservation of the environment. The federal government's Bill C-5 would reduce environmental protections to allow the construction of nation-building projects. The Ontario government has put forward a similar bill, similarly named Bill 5, which would create special economic zones in the province in which all environmental regulations could be disregarded. Suzuki says that this legislation and others like it put our future at risk, and that instead, preserving nature should be at the forefront of our decision making, economic or otherwise. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
I teach my children about systemic racism and about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up, and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.